is really a separate point, which is now that we have our reasons why the communities formed that we talked about in the beginning, and we have some of the founders and some of the interaction, what I want to do is talk about some of the major differences that we know between Ashkenazim and Sephardim that appear to have been around in the early communities, but not necessarily as early and clear-cut as people think. So I prepared sources on your sheet for three practices. One, kitnios, rice and beans on Pesach. Second one, the pronunciation of Hebrew letters or vowels. And third, the position of a Torah scroll, a Sefer Torah. And we'll see how far we get. We've got 35 minutes. We can make a dent. Okay? All right. So first of all, kitnios. And I'm simplifying because you have to in order to get through any of this. But I think there's enough information here that it'll be clear. There's a basic rule, first of all, in terms of Passover. A plant that is eligible to produce matzah, you can make flour out of it that will be usable for matzah, can make chametz. If you let the flour rise, it becomes chametz. If it doesn't rise, then it becomes matzah. If the plant can't be used for matzah, if it's ineligible for matzah, then it also can't generate chametz. So for example, if I were to make potato flour, and try to make matzah out of it, bake it as matzah, I don't know if it would work. But if I tried to bake that as matzah, it would not be eligible as matzah for my Seder. Because it can't become chametz. Therefore, it can't make matzah either. On the other hand, if I take wheat, and I expose it to water, and I let it rise, that makes chametz. So you can't use rice to make matzah, because rice can't become chametz. You follow that? That's a basic rule. Which is why, if you take a look at source number 9, the Talmud is talking about the Ka'ara, the Seder plate. And the Seder plate is supposed to include two cooked foods. Today, it's popular to use the Zroa and the Beitza. Right? The Zroa, the shank bone, and the Beitza, the egg. Uh-huh. Right? What vegetarians do is a discussion for another time. But that's been the standard for a very long time. But in the Talmud's time, not everybody was using Zroa and Beitza. Not everyone was using the shank bone and the egg. Take a look at source number 9. What two cooked foods do you put on your Seder plate? Rav Huna said, beets and rice. So first of all, your vegetarians are fine. But only your Sephardi vegetarians. Because your Ashkenazi vegetarians are like, wait, what's rice doing on your Seder plate? We don't eat rice on Passover. But Rav Huna did. Because the idea of not having rice is part of this kitnios practice that we're now going to discuss. But the basic thing is, only certain things can become chametz. The traditional list that people are familiar with is wheat, barley, rye, oats, and spelt. There's reason for discussion about the oats part and potentially the spelt part, but that's so not where we're going right now. I want to stay focused if I can. So according to this, rice is fine on Passover, beans are fine on Passover, corn is fine on Passover, and there's no issue. However, going back to Talmudic times, there have always been rabbinic laws that were meant to keep people from generating chametz accidentally. So for example, take a look at source number 10. Rav Papi permitted the Exilarch's bakers to thicken a pot with roasted grain. They took grain kernels that had not been baked. They had been roasted. And they would put it into a pot that they were cooking in. And the reason was because the grain was already roasted and it's not going to rise anymore. There's no concern that you expose it to liquid and now it's going to rise. So therefore, Rav Papi said, it's okay to do that. The Exilarch was the political leader of the Jews living outside of Israel. And he said, you could do it. Rava said, what in the world are you doing? Does anyone permit such a thing in a place where there are servants? Meaning, you have people there who are not trained, they're not educated well, and they're handling all of this, and they're going to think you could put grain in a pot. They're not going to know, well, this is roasted grain, this is not roasted grain. They get careless. No way. He says, you're not allowed to cook a food which could be confused with chametz, lest people then make chametz. That's one example. Another example is a classic in source number 11. Now, today, like, no one would even think of doing this. No one bakes from scratch on Passover. Like, that's just not, you may take a mix, but you're not baking things from scratch on Passover. There's a fear it's going to become chametz. But in Talmudic times, when you don't have mixes and you don't have preservatives, and everybody has these ovens that they're able to bake with apparently at a very high level, and they're not afraid that it's going to become chametz, so they would bake on Passover. But there was a baker who was named Baitus. Baitus was at one point a very wealthy family in Jerusalem. I don't know if there's a relationship. But this fellow named Baitus, Bothus, is a baker. And he says, I have a mold that I can use to bake cakes. And hang on one second. I'm just going to mute the background noise. I can mute the background noise on the Zoom. I can't mute the background noise in the hallway. He says, I can bake cakes in a mold, in a pan, and they'll bake really, really fast, and they'll be nice and fancy for people for Passover, and they won't become chametz. So he asks the sages, am I allowed to do that? Rabbi Yehuda said, Bothus, son of Zonin, asked this of the sages. Why did they say one may not make decorated cakes on Pesach, on Passover? And they replied, because women tarry in making them, it takes a long time. Apparently the women were the bakers. Don't be shocked, but the women were the bakers. And they took a long time in making them, and they become chametz. So he said, look, we could make them in a mold and establish them directly. They'll bake a lot faster. You save a lot of processing time if you do it in a mold. To which they replied, well, people then say that all such cakes are prohibited, but the cakes of Bothus are permitted? Meaning no one is going to realize that your cakes are okay because you manufacture them with a special process that's a lot faster. They're going to assume that everybody is allowed to do it. So this is another case where you had rabbinic legislation that was meant to prevent people from confusion that would lead to potential generation of chametz. Because the prohibition against chametz is so severe, you have layers of legislation. That's Talmudic times. That's long before the Ashkenazi-Sephardi split that we're talking about. That's like 6 centuries before what we're talking about. Fast forward now to somewhere around the 11th or 12th century, and we don't know precisely when. A practice developed in Ashkenazi communities of not eating certain foods on Passover because they could lead to chametz. And this becomes known as kitnios. Kitnios literally refers to legumes or beans. But we apply it to refer to things that are not legumes or beans, like rice, as an example. So they were concerned about certain plants. And in number 12, I gave you the 3 reasons they were concerned. One concern was that they had plants which had kernels that were collected in piles, like chametz, like wheat and barley, but these weren't wheat and barley. You had another concern that people prepare these plants, they create a flour out of them that looks just like wheat flour, barley flour, or they bake them into things that look just like regular things, right? Like today, you can get bagels made and pasta made with potato flour. Fortunately, they didn't have potatoes, and therefore they didn't ban their use. But the point was, there's confusion between the products that you generate with them, and that's a concern. Or cross-contamination was mentioned later in history. specifically that when they collect these things in the field, there's grain that gets mixed in. That's another concern. I saw a great article online. The first time I saw somebody say this, which I've been saying for years. You know, Dr. Kirshen notes in the chat, there was a story of someone who did try to ban potatoes. This is true. It wasn't just someone. I think it was the Chaye Adam, who argued that potatoes now should be prohibited. This has to do with whether I view the whole practice of avoiding kitnios as a decree or as a custom. And is it expandable? Does everything that fits into its logic automatically come under its purview? It's a longer discussion that has come up in more recent years regarding quinoa. Same type of a conversation. So, but what I was going to say was that I've had the experience of opening boxes of cereal or other foods and finding something in there that isn't supposed to be in there. Right? It's not on the ingredients list. You'll open one box of cereal and you'll find another thing in there from some other cereal because they're processed together in the plant and sometimes things get mixed together. So Rabbi Elie Fisher wrote an article called Why Are These Cheerios Different from All Other Cheerios? You can see it was published Pesach time in 2016. The story was that Cheerios invested a great deal of money in making gluten-free Cheerios. Now, anybody who knows anything about gluten-free, or gluten, knows that Cheerios shouldn't have gluten anyway, because Cheerios is made out of oats, and oats don't have gluten. That's why there's speculation that oats shouldn't be on the list of grains for matzah and chametz altogether, because they don't have gluten. So what was Cheerios doing when they created gluten-free Cheerios? What did that mean? So take a look in source number 13, Rabbi Fisher's article. As General Mills discovered, making this product fully gluten-free turned out to be exceedingly difficult. Since farmers rotate their crops, the same fields in which gluten-free oats grow one year may have cultivated wheat, barley, or rye in the prior year. Moreover, gluten-containing grains are stored in the same granaries, transported in the same containers used for oats. As a result, nearly all oats available on an industrial scale are contaminated by wheat, barley, or rye. For Cheerios to become strictly gluten-free, General Mills had to develop a method for separating oat kernels from grain kernels on a massive scale, which they proceeded to do. Successfully, with the exception of one embarrassing episode last fall when one facility accidentally replaced oat flour with wheat flour, forcing a gigantic recall of gluten-free Cheerios containing gluten. This is why, or maybe why, sometimes someone who has a sensitive stomach will eat some food that is not supposed to have gluten in it, and they'll react to it anyway. Because this is not so simple in terms of the way that our processing works. So the contamination was a concern for them in terms of their kitnios production, their production of these items. There are more explanations that are offered for kitnios, but those are the three primary ones. A concern that these are plants that have product that are processed the same way out in the fields, or they create end products that can be confused with chametz, or there's a concern for cross-contamination. This is all in Ashkenazi communities. However, in most Sephardic lands, we never find this. This doesn't develop. Not at all. There are Sephardic lands where some of this did apply, but in most Sephardic lands, you do not find this whole thing of avoiding kitnios. Why not? So it could be because of the separation of the communities. The communities don't adopt all the same practices. Also, even in Ashkenazi lands, it was controversial in the early going. Some of Rashi's grandsons spoke out against the kitnios practices. They felt that it was incorrect. They felt that it was too much of a stringency and that it wasn't warranted. However, I saw a great suggestion which shows up in Rabbi Fisher's article, so I brought it in source number 14, explaining that it had to do with how farming worked in Ashkenazi countries versus in Sephardi countries. something called the three-field system. And it's very interesting because of a nuance that was discovered only recently. In order to explain, I gave you three different explanations for the kitnios concern. The last explanation that I brought you, the one we spent the most time on, was the concern for cross-contamination. You think that what you've got is rice, and in fact, there are wheat kernels in there. That type of a concern. So that concern does not seem to have been an original concern for kitnios, because it only shows up in the classic literature in the 14th century, after this practice is well developed. But now watch this. Take a look at number 14 from that article from Rabbi Fisher. He talks about the three-field system of crop rotation. And he says, could the development of this three-field system and the huge increase in the cultivation of legumes explain why the custom to refrain from legumes on Passover arose specifically in late medieval Ashkenaz? Could it be because of this cultivation of legumes in their fields? That theory was first put forward in the early 1990s by Nachum Bronsnick, a retired professor of Hebrew at Rutgers University, and further elaborated by a plant scientist named Ari Schaefer at Israel's Volcani Center. Although it had the ring of truth, it was also problematic, specifically because the first mentions of this custom by rabbinic authorities, which date from the 13th century, offer different reasons for it. It's actually 12, but they offer different reasons for it, namely, kitniot resemble chametz, they're cooked like chametz, they rise like chametz, they even sound like chametz. That's a whole thing about chickpeas. Not until a century later do several authorities offer admixture as the reason for the custom. A custom of which, however, they emphatically disapprove, calling it excessive, mistaken, and foolish. But all these disapproving rabbis hailed from Spain or Provence, where the two-field system still prevailed. So again, to make sure that we understand what he's saying. What he's saying is, some wanted to suggest that it was because of the system of crop rotation that led to mixing. However, that practice of crop rotation wasn't the issue of mixing wasn't one of the original reasons given for the kitnios concern. That reason is only mentioned by Sfardim later, who are criticizing the restriction against kitnios. So how could that have been a reason for it? So he then goes on and explains. The crop rotation theory of the origin of kitniot received a major boost in 2006 with the publication of a newly discovered Passover sermon by Rabbi Elazar of Worms, a major Rhineland community, from the late 12th or early 13th century. The sermon contains a single line. We do not eat beans and lentils because there is wheat in them. That offers both the first attested reference to concern for admixture and the earliest reference to the practice of refraining from kitniot on Passover. The codicologist Simcha Emanuel of the Hebrew University, who published the sermon, has linked this concern with admixture to the three-field system of crop rotation. You follow? So now we know that, in fact, in the early days of kitniot, the concern was for a mixture of wheat in the beans and lentils harvest. And that was when the three-field crop rotation system was in use. So it's entirely possible that the reason why Ashkenazim refrain and the Sfardim are fine with it has to do with how farming was done in Ashkenazi lands versus how farming was done in Sfardi lands. Was that too much, or we're good? Yeah, Janine.
The two examples you gave us in the Talmud are not discussing kitniot, they're discussing how the wheat was processed. Was the concept of kitniot, I don't know, was there something about mustard? Like, is there any discussion of this in the Talmud?
So I brought those only to show rabbinic legislation, which is concerned about confusion of products, because the logic is found also when it comes to kitniot. That's number one. Number two, if you wanted to trace it to the Talmud, there are a couple of sources you could bring. One is, there is discussion about wheat kernels being found talmudically in with mustard as an example. They use mustard often as a pollinator. there's a whole discussion about that. That's not for right now. But you did have issues, potential mixtures, I believe. That's number one. Number two, you have an idea which is separate from this, but that is that maybe rice is able to create a form of chametz based on a possible read of a passage in the Talmud. It's generally not accepted, but there is a possible read in that regard. But really, Kineos, I don't think it needs to be traced to the Talmud. The logic of the decree is really what's Talmudic. Roslyn, you were going to say.
Right.
No. Nope.
So why is rice, and you can't make matzah out of it, so.
Correct.
Why is it considered kiddiyot?
So, you're right, but it's not about being a legume. It's, and I apologize for my pronunciation of legume. I know everyone does their own thing on that one. But it's not about it being a legume. It's about whether the concerns that I listed in number 12 apply to it. So is there a concern that you process it by harvesting it in the same way? Is the concern that the products are, that you generate with it are going to be similar? Is it a concern for cross-contamination that wheat is going to end up in the rice? But it's not about whether it's officially a legume or not. Even though the word kitnios means legumes, it has come to mean so much more. We include corn. Corn is absolutely not a legume. As I understand it, maybe I'm saying something wrong, but I don't think so. The corn ends up on the list for other reasons. I got a message that my audio is breaking up. Is that true for everybody? No. Okay.
So. But one more thing about rice. Rice is grown in a totally different way, I understand, than wheat. It's like you need water. It's like you need these rice paddies. It's in fields that wheat won't grow in.
Right. Someone actually messaged that in the chat right now, saying rice is grown under completely different conditions in wet land. Right. The concern with rice would not have been the admixture concern. It wouldn't have been about wheat being mixed in with the rice. The concern would have been one of the other considerations about the way that it's harvested or confusion of products. I don't know which one of these was the original concern. Rose.
And also, I just want to ask, you know, when you make rice, it's possible as a grain, and then rice, like,
it's
big.
Yeah.
Is that a concern?
Right, so that's actually...
When it rises?
So that's actually discussed in the Talmud, and they distinguish between fermentation of grains and the swelling of rice. And the Talmud explicitly says that's a different thing, that it's not the same. Yeah. We actually did, for my Beit Midrash, many years ago, those of you who were in a class with Rabbi Ziering at any point when he was with us, it was his idea. We did a science project before Passover, and we made a dough or dough-like things out of a whole bunch of different things. We made it with wheat flour that we had added yeast to, wheat flour that we did not add yeast to, whole wheat, rice. We tried a whole bunch of things to demonstrate which things rise, which things don't rise, which things rise, but they don't really create a dough, you know, but they're creating something else. It was a fascinating and fun thing. I should try that again sometime. I want to move into the Hebrew pronunciation so we can at least deal with that. We're not going to get to the Torah scroll positions, unfortunately, but I want to do the pronunciation because that's a big one people like to ask about. So some of the differences between Ashkenazi pronunciation of Hebrew and Sephardi pronunciation of Hebrew. I would poll you, but we only have 11 minutes, so I'm just going to say it. The last letter in the Hebrew alphabet is pronounced it can have a dot in it, or it could be without a dot in it. The dot, which is called a dagesh, is there for grammatical reasons. Sometimes it needs to be there, sometimes it does not need to be there. When there's no dot, when there's no dagesh, so Sfardim tend to say T, they'll make a T sound. Ashkenazim will tend to use an S sound. Yemenites will do a TH sound. They'll do th. So that's one of the differences. Another difference, the letters Gimel and Ayin among Ashkenazim will be pronounced like I just did. Gimel is G, Ayin is A. Whereas in Yemenites and some Sephardim, they pronounce them as guttural sounds out of the throat. So it's ga. And the ayin is ga. If you didn't hear any difference, it's because I'm an Ashkenazi trying to pretend I'm a Sephardi. And then you will have some who actually do the letter gimel as a zh. They'll do a zh sound. Another one, also along the lines of the guttural point, there's a letter kaf, and then there's a letter kuf. Ashkenazim tend to treat them the same. They're both ka. Sephardim will do the letter kaf as ka, and the letter kuf they'll do again as ka. Like a Q type of a sound. There's also a vowel, which it looks like a T, goes under the letter, and Ashkenazim, well, first of all, there are two. There's one called a kamatz katan and one called a kamatz gadol. For, again, reasons of accents and grammar that don't affect us right now. But the way that it historically worked, I believe, was that a kamatz katan was almost an O sound. Ho. O. Like that. Whereas a kamatz gadol is a. A. Sephardim tend to pronounce the kamatz as a. Unless they're from a community where they really make the distinction for the kamatz katan, kamatz gadol, but the regular kamatz, they'll do a. Whereas Ashkenazim will do a. You hear it? You hear the difference? So the question is, where does all of this come from? So differences in pronouncing Hebrew letters go all the way back to Tanakh. They go all the way back to biblical text. As an example, I brought you source number 15. This is a famous one. The story of Yiftach and the people he didn't like. Yiftach was, he's a whole story, so I'm not going to try to do him justice. But he was a shofet, he's one of the judges, and he rescues the Jews who are under attack by the nation of Ammon. And then he has a fight with the tribe of Ephraim, because they protest and say, hey, why didn't you call us when you were doing this? And instead of making peace with them, as happened with another shofet earlier in the book of Shoftim, the book of Judges, he has a fight with them, and it becomes a civil war. And when the tribe of Ephraim are trying to escape, they have to get across a river crossing that he controls. And so everybody who gets to the river crossing is told they have to say a particular word. If you take a look at source number 15, when someone would come to the river, they would say to him, say shibolet. A shibolet is what's the word I'm looking for? Not a sheaf. It's grain, but it's not a sheaf. It's something else. But, you know, it's a stalk. Sorry, it's a stalk. So, say shibolet, but they couldn't say shibolet. They would say sibolet. And then they would know that this person was actually from that tribe. They couldn't say sibolet, they would say sibolet. That's made it into English. There's a word in English, a shibboleth. So, the background noise that you're hearing is not, Sylvia, is not from the people on the Zoom. It's from the hallway here. We're between periods again. Unfortunately, asking them to mute is not going to work. So the fact that you had Jews who couldn't pronounce the sh sound has been explained in different ways, but Rav Sadia Gaon, writing in the 10th century, said it came about because these Jews lived among populations who didn't use the sh sound. That wasn't a sound that they used in their language, and therefore the Jews ended up using it less. Another example of this, moving forward to Talmudic times, is in source number 16, where we're told not to use leaders of the services from Beit Sha'an or Beit Haifa or from Tiv Onin. Why? Because they pronounce their aleph and their ayin the same. They say their alephs as ayins and their ayins as alephs, and the true way to do it is the ayin is guttural. It's an ah sound. They're not supposed to be the same sound. So where and when did this develop? So Professor Zimmels, who I've been quoting, in his Ashkenazim and Sfardim work, brings three ideas. The first idea is that Sfard is the original. And Ashkenazim came along, Ashkenazi pronunciation came later because of the populations in which we lived, like Rav Sadia Gaon's idea. They, Miriam, to answer your question, Sfardic. The second idea is that actually both pronunciations existed in ancient times, and that Israel had the Ashkenazi, the Israeli population that ended up being Ashkenazi had what we call Ashkenazi pronunciation, whereas the Jews in Israel who ended up in Babylon and Bavel had the Sephardi pronunciation. Remember, we've said that the Jews in Spain tended to follow Babylonian practice. The Jews in Italy and then Germany tended to follow Israeli practice. And he points to an ancient Near Eastern language called Syriac that also had two forms of pronunciation for some of it. So he says maybe that's what was going on. And then the third idea is that the Ashkenazi was the original pronunciation and the Sephardi developed in Spain. So I brought all three for you in source number 17, where he says this. But I just wanted to point out, rather than read it aloud, I wanted to point out a few things. Number one, and this is a major point that he notes, we don't find responsa on this problem of why do we have two different kinds and which one is correct in the early days of Ashkenaz and Sfard. The responsa and the questions of what do we do in our community, who should lead services, how should they lead services, those aren't there in the early centuries, which leads some to suggest that that supports the idea that one of those develops later. Whether it's Ashkenaz or Sfard, but one of those develops later. Some of the evidence supports the first contention, that Sfard is the original. So, for example, we have texts that show up in early Ashkenaz, where the vowels are written in. Remember that for much of Jewish history, we didn't write the vowels in. It was just known. You knew how to pronounce a word. But we do find texts in early Ashkenaz that have vowels that use the patach, the a vowel, instead of the a, kamatz vowel, where it really should be a kamatz, suggesting that they were pronouncing the word like Sfard would pronounce it. They were pronouncing it with an a, and therefore they wrote the a vowel. I really should have put the vowels on the sheet. That would have made it a lot easier to explain this. Another is that you find certain words that are transcribed into Latin characters that use the Sephardic pronunciation in those early centuries. They're transcribed with a T for the letter Saf instead of an S, indicating that they would have been using the Taf. So there's evidence to support the idea that the Sephardic is the original. You find responsa in our day that say that the Yemenite is considered to be the most authentic of Hebrew pronunciations. When Rabbi Dr. Zimmels wrote his work Ashkenazim and Sfardim in the middle of the 20th century, he said that historians of his day actually favored the idea that they're both original, that Ashkenaz and Sfard are ancient methods of pronouncing Hebrew words, Hebrew letters. And neither of them is the original. They're both original. Which is a nice diplomatic way to conclude this. I don't know if it's historically accurate, but it's a nice diplomatic way to approach it. Questions and comments? Yeah, Janine.
I'm interested in this topic. And I was just looking up something. I was Googling and I came across this article. It must have been a reading course at York University, and I found it very interesting that a lot of the reason why Israel today uses Sephardi pronunciation was not necessarily because the Sephardim were there first, but it was the earliest foundation of using Hebrew in modern day was done by people who were rebelling against the shtetl.
Yes.
So then Sephardi was a much more prestigious
So what I have seen, and I wasn't going to talk about it today, so I don't have sources to particularly give you, but I think Naftali Wesley was very big on this in the Manga Maskilim, was they considered the Sephardic pronunciation crisper and more aesthetically pleasing. And the Maskilim were looking to break with the past, which surely, you know, helped with this. So you did have that. But on the other hand, the Rebbe of the Chasam Sofer, Rav Nathan Adler, brought in a Sephardi to teach him Hebrew pronunciation. I believe he lived in his house for 3 years, this fellow, to teach him Sephardic pronunciation because he felt that was what he ought to be using. So it wasn't just the Maskilim that were, you know, fans of Sephard, but it's true. The Maskilim felt that this fit their more cultured and enlightened approach. Roslyn. You want to say? Oh, okay. So, alright, so we're going to stop there. I'm not going to get to discuss the position of the Torah scroll, which is, okay, something that would be good to know about. You can see the sources there and possibly reconstruct it. I'm planning on, first of all, I hope you'll be able to be there for the June 7th class at Beth Emmett. That's number one. It'll be probably in the boardroom upstairs. If we outgrow the boardroom, which we might based on registration so far, we'll use the big room upstairs, I think. If we really outgrow it, we'll use the ballroom downstairs. I don't know. We'll see. We've done that before. But first of all, I'm retaining this email address. So I'm always going to be reachable, God willing. And also, I will still be teaching some things for the Beit Midrash next year. If you're on the Beit Midrash email list, you'll get notifications for what those are. I'm definitely hoping to be in